Had enough of the been there, done that ideas? Tired of too much talk and so little action? Rewind now and welcome to Transformation and Change Radio with Dr. Kathy Obair, where the vision of true equity, inclusion, courage, and purpose meet powerfully. Dr. Kathy delivers with dynamic, engaging conversation in the most authentically brave dialogue on air today. This hit show will challenge you to explore current issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion and deepen your capacity to choose courage to speak up to greater inclusion in everything you do. Fasten your seatbelts and accelerate your effectiveness to become a powerful change agent in your life, community, job, and society. Imagine true equity and inclusion and get the tools to really manifest your vision. No frills, no fluff, just really powerful, good stuff. Transformation and Change Radio starts now.
Welcome to Center and Transformation Radio. I'm Dr. Kathy Obair, and I could not be more excited to welcome back to the show Dr. Mwaba Gooden. Hello, Vice President for Division of Equity, Diversity, Inclusion at Kent State University. If you didn't get the last show, I encourage you to listen to it. We're going to keep building because this one, I'm really excited to revisit ideas of innovative ways to do hiring, onboarding, promotion, retention of faculty of color, Indigenous faculty in this national context. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kathy. So happy that I'm here.
And folks that want to know more, a really robust biography is on the website. But you may know Dr. Gooden's work from whether it's Kent State, University of Guelph, Temple, if I got that right. What I'm particularly excited about for today is your background as a chair for, was it 9 years, the Department of Pan-African Studies at Kent State?
Yes.
And then now as a vice president of really strategic partnering with senior leaders, looking at hiring, promotion, culture change, all of that as we really focus on. So what could be some innovative, practical, in these times, hiring promotion? So welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, Kathy.
To start us off, would you share just a bit about yourself and particularly around the work of supporting faculty, maybe even staff, hiring with a race lens, and maybe what you noticed early on, what you're beginning to notice now, and then we can leap into some of the details.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll talk about, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion work, both historically and contemporary, because it's changed so much, I think, over the last, I would say, you know, 5 to 10 years, where if we're thinking back in the early 1960s, when diversity work came to be in higher ed, it was really addressing the absence of African Americans in particular in the spaces. And then over time, it became a little bit more complex to include other marginalized individuals. So Indigenous folks, members of our Latino population, diversity work now includes age and ability, veteran status, and political thought. And in some ways, I think complicating diversity is a wonderful thing. But the challenge is also, right, that it becomes so convoluted, it becomes diluted. And we use diversity for this synonymous for so many other things, where we no longer want to be specific in the language that we're talking about. There's also the challenge of only focusing on compositional diversity, you know, including those bodies in white spaces without challenging those white spaces, without challenging systems of oppression. And I think this is where diversity work is now, where I think 2020 and the racial reckoning has really pushed organizations, institutions to rethink in an intentional and sustained way, systemic and organizational change. So not being reactive, but being proactive. And which means, right, looking at hiring, recruitment, but promotion, right, and retaining the people that you're going to hire, which means we've got to transform the spaces in which they're working in.
As you're talking, I also have this memory that in that late 60s, 70s time where there were some compositional diversity changes in hiring, that actually with affirmative action focus, it's actually white women like me that benefited the most.
Yes.
The resistance focuses on people of color. Why are we doing this? Special programs. But the benefactors have been white women, and actually sometimes white women are the most resistant to having a more racially diverse, culturally competent pool and group of hires.
Yeah, and thank you for mentioning that, Kathy, because there is a fear, I think, in talking about that, right? Who affirmative action? Well, I mean, there's just fear in talking about affirmative action in general, but there's a stereotypical notion or thinking in terms of who it's actually benefited. And I think if Americans understood that data and who's benefited from affirmative action, I think we can have clear and more honest conversations around race in the country.
I like your dreaming.
I
know you're having those conversations. I know I am, and the resistance, the backpedaling. So in this moment, because now we're now February 2023, in this specific context, why do you think it's critical that senior leaders in academia across college, universities, maybe even outside, really continue to keep a race focus in hiring? And we're not saying only, but we are saying, as you said, I love that line, when it gets convoluted, it gets diluted.
Yeah.
And so why do we have to intentionally keep race-centered
hiring,
attracting a racially diverse, culturally competent pool in hires? What's the why for that?
There's so many benefits for having a diverse population, but I'm going to talk a little bit about the failure of that initial initiative from the 1960s. So we've been trying to diversify institutions of higher education since the 1960s, and we're still trying to diversify. Numbers have changed very little. Yeah. So there's a failure, right? I can think in terms of how it's been operationalized on university and college campus. So there has to be a rethinking of how we do that work. I think if we align that with the experiences of Black and Brown folks in institutions of higher education, the low percentage of PhDs in those full professor positions or even in administrative positions, but also just the benefit of having very diverse staff, right, that benefits student learning and student outcomes, right, having staff and faculty model a way of being not just for Black and Brown students, but also for their white colleagues in terms of how they produce and work, but also just generally of the production of knowledge.
I was just at a university really framing similarly the life skills, career skills that students across racialized identities need, and that corporations, law schools, healthcare are demanding.
Yeah.
And that having a racially diverse, culturally competent faculty, staff, administrators is one piece of developing our students to be career ready, which is that buzzword these days. But it is critical.
Yeah. And you know, there's a tension, you know, that I sit with when we talk about the benefits of diversity, because I think of the way in which diversity is branded and marketed in a neoliberal university, where, you know, Black and Brown bodies are managed and branded on a recruitment, right, in recruitment campaigns as posters for website, yet they're not thriving in those spaces. So there's a tension for me when I talk about that. And so I do think we have to talk about diversity along with that systemic organizational change.
Yeah. The revolving door, I think we talked about last time, but the climate, the culture, I'm still struck with the use of the word branded.
Yeah.
Used, abused, make us look good,
but
we can just replace you and don't rock the boat too much and just stay in your place. Just the way dominant white culture, white supremacy culture continues to just literally impact the mental health, physical health, life of so many Black and Brown faculty and staff.
Yeah, it reminds me of Sarah Ahmed's, her article, Phenomenology of Whiteness, where she talks about happy diversity, right? That universities really, that there's that tension, but there's a concern when universities focus on branding or marketing diversity as a form of success, right? They've achieved and arrived at the place of being diverse, and it really pushes back against the voices of those who are marginalized in terms of sharing their experiences. And so universities sometimes, and we've seen this, right? Only want to look and provide stats on how well they're doing in the diversity space.
And those stats of, look, yes, our numbers haven't changed much, but they've improved 0.2%. but not going deeper, as I know you're saying, of let's look at how long people stay, what the quality of life is, why they leave.
Yeah.
And the other thing that comes up, and then we can hop into this, because I know you've been doing some national conversations of reimagining hiring, onboarding. I was just talking with, it happened to be four Black folk on a university campus, faculty and mid-senior level staff, just the exhaustion of all the less apparent labor they were doing, all the advising that their white counterparts were not competent to do, and much less, this was a first year faculty member was invited and actually voluntold to be on the diversity committee and on this committee, and then that doesn't count in tenure.
Yes.
And so even though the senior leader said it did, the truth was from them, it's like, no, it doesn't. And so how we are taking advantage of, because white folks are not doing their job, much less competent to truly create success for the full breadth of students we are supposed to be serving.
Yeah, there's an article, and I wish I could remember the name, that really talks about Black women being the maids of the academy.
Ooh.
Being always in service, in a service position, and in very qualitative ways, and the university does not quantify that labor, so that there is, right, the way in which their work is not valued, they're of service, they're doing great work with students, with other faculty, and they run the risk of not being tenured and promoted, and then after, right, they've they've put, you know, hundreds of hours of labor in service and in community for the university.
And how many are then, quote, let go because they're pushing the envelope too much. They're raising their voice too much. They're not a good fit. And the belief is then we can just hire some more and still keep our stats.
Yeah.
Listeners, keep breathing. Helping your colleagues, leaders understand the landscape within historical and current, and not just what else could be different, because a new idea that you might hear today will only be useful if it's within the context of what your organization is doing. And so when you told me you were holding space with lots of folks across, when I say the nation, I apologize, I mean the U.S., because you have Canadian, Jamaican, as well as U.S. backgrounds, much less worked in other countries, I think consulting. So love to hear what were some of the highlights or insights about onboarding, hiring, retention, culture change that you heard, and then we'll just keep going.
You know, I appreciate being in conversation with colleagues, not just in the U.S., but in fact across the world, about reimagining the academy, particularly in colonial spaces, you know, and that's going to take some work for us to rethink, redesign the academy. I've actually learned quite a lot from Black feminist scholars. So here I'm thinking about Hook. There is an article that actually calls on the Combahee River Collective in terms of what we can learn from that practice. And I'm thinking of an article that I'm actually an author in. Joelle Cruz is the first author, The Equi Collective, and another article on radical Black feminism, right? And this space, this kind of idea of learning from the Black feminist radical tradition as a way of decentering whiteness and reimagining the academy. Because in essence, if you're taking care, right, if you think of Black women and you take care of their needs and their concerns in the academy, you're actually taking care of the entire community, right? So in a lot of ways, focusing on gender and race and centering Black women actually takes care of white folks, right? Members of the LGBTQ plus or veterans. And so one of the things I've learned is that when we think about Black feminism and we think about what they offer, is that the first stance is collective action, change for all, and actually attending to structural inequities. Mm. So as I mentioned before, this idea of focusing on compositional diversity is welcomed and should happen, but you can't attend to people that you're inviting into the academy if you're not addressing the structural inequities. So in addition to focusing on recruitment and hiring practices, what are you doing to ensure that you're going to retain your faculty? Are there other bodies that look like them in your units and in your spaces? Because we know that the data indicates that for individuals who are the one and only person in their department, that's a difficult place to thrive. You might survive if you stay and you get tenure, but it's really a difficult place to thrive. So having more than one individual in your department is key. Attending to issues around handbook for faculty who, around promotion and tenure, for example, are there expectations that the faculty are only expected to produce and to publish in, you know, journals that center whiteness, that are difficult to get in? How are faculty who write on race and gender and other forms of difference, how are they able to thrive and survive in a department that has a very rigid and white-centered handbook? Some of the examples, I think, that individuals can think of, at least should think about as they're thinking about recruitment, hiring, and retention.
So if we kind of spend a little time on each of those, I've been able to work with a couple places that have been doing cohort hiring and really being clear they want critical scholars. Again, I know we're focusing a bit more on faculty, but listeners, you can probably broaden this. So folks that have a demonstrated capacity in their research, in their teaching, and in their advising to support the success, full breadth of students, particularly students of color that have been underserved for so many centuries. I was about to say decades, but that's not long enough. And so the competencies they focused on, in addition to compositional diversity, that combination, I'm thinking of this one college that brought in, I think, 13 people last year, and 12, all were critical scholars, and 12 were folks of color, indigenous folk. And so the cohort of a community, and I believe they then are connected to the cohort before. And so the onboarding is not just a couple HR hours, but it truly is about building connections, relationships. So,
And that's a great example of, you know, how to build community in a space that lacks, right, diversity around, you know, for racialized and minoritized individual. So we know that individuals having a sustained community on campus, in the department and outside of the department is really important. But I can't stress enough that's structural changes that address things like decision making at the faculty level. So is it all full professors who are white sitting and making decisions on the new faculty that are coming in? So what can be addressed in the handbook that would actually give voice to individuals of color, those that are racialized and minoritized? Do they have a voice on faculty senate? Are they included to kind of non-departmental events? What culture of practice do you have that would welcome new faculty into your space? Those are really clear things to attend to. Are there community engagements? We often say rules of engagement, if you will, but I'm talking about community agreements that are created by all faculty. Do junior faculty have a voice in how we're going to engage with each other at the table in making decisions and how their voices are valued? Those are really kind of, I think, really intentional and best practices to think about for the success of our junior faculty.
So could you imagine, listeners, if on the website and then actually letters to people that apply says, or even before they apply, people of interest to say, this is the culture we are working to co-create. Mm-hmm. Here are the changes we've made, the structural changes. Here's our intent to provide these opportunities, to remove these barriers so that junior faculty, teaching faculty come in, and these are opportunities to influence and co-create collectively. These are the kinds of professional development. These are how we do staff meetings. And as we start each year, we will co-create our engaging agreements, collectively decide what are the professional development we need so that we continue on this anti-racism journey. Yeah. I'd never thought of all of those structural changes as part of the marketing, and that let people know who you are, who you say you want to be, and how far you've come, and how people coming in will be opportunities to actively co-create and get support for promotion, tenure.
And Kathy, and holding each other accountable. So it's really important, right, that you know, white faculty hold their colleagues accountable for their behavior at those decision-making tables. And I know you run, you know, workshops on microaggressions. So following some of those examples in terms of calling people in, pushing back on when those things come up, because it does create a positive culture for a new junior faculty of color.
I was recently somewhere, I was talking to someone yesterday I've known for years to say, we've done all the easy things. That was how they framed it. We've changed all the policies. And I thought, easy. But they really have 5 years of changing structurally policies. And what they're seeing is, but it hasn't infiltrated to the culture in the day-to-day. So they still have a revolving door. They have a toxic environment. There's not psychological safety. I know I'm throwing out some terms, but listeners, those are the terms that are being used these days.
Yeah.
Also. And so it just reminds me how long culture change takes. And even if you change hiring practices, these are the questions we're going to have. We're going to change the website. We're going to train all the folks in the hiring committee, require them to look at bias, microaggressions, train how to interrupt them, hiring as well as afterwards. But unless that team, like a faculty department, staff department work is done to really change the culture, climate, and skill development, I believe then you're going to keep the revolving door.
Yeah.
I don't know what you think.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think, you know, I always think that the leader of such a unit and more than one individual, right, needs to actually have or understand that lens of oppression in terms of how it can manifest as racism and transphobia and heterosexism. And because that does impact the culture. It's so important that we have critical scholars, right, critical race scholars at the table that understand systems of oppression and its intersecting dynamics, that are able to see that when it shows up and actually call in people and push back. But so more important to have more than one individual at that table.
You know, the kind of leading practice is having an equity advocate, and they might call it a diversity. And it's often a person of color, often not a tenured person, who then the risk is high. And so I want to underline or join you in what you said. It's really the white faculty who need this training and who be calling in and out other white faculty who covert and overt racist comments. You know, they had a typo in their cover letter, or their research isn't quite what we're teaching here. Covert racist comments as well as the more blatant. And that's a lot of investment and development. All right, I'm not faculty, so push back if I'm kind of in my bias. I find faculty generally resistant to this level of learning and development because they get told and promoted because they're told they're competent and experts. And so particularly with white faculty, to point out, actually, there's this whole area of competencies that you do not have. And in fact, you're perpetuating whiteness, racist dynamics. The resistance has been huge. And I'm a white person with a doctorate, and I can't imagine the resistance that folk of color experience. Except
yeah,
for
yeah. I think one of the most difficult things is to enter space, you know, and send your humility, your own humility, and to enter that as a student, especially as a faculty member with a PhD who's supposed to be an expert. Yeah. So it's difficult, and it's difficult for individuals of color doing this work or sitting through some of the sessions that we offer that that might experience triggers or have lived through the biases, and not having individuals in those sessions own up, right? Because they are the perpetrators. Yeah.
Just had a brand new thought. A lot of folks do hiring committee training, but what if we did that in affinity and accountability space? Because the one or two folk of color that are on the committee, and they're like, this is the 20th one I've done in 5 years. So I don't know. Because I think the role and the risk is different for Indigenous folk of color on those committees than it is for white. So new thought.
Yeah, that's interesting, right? Because in one ways, you know, whiteness shows up both in culture, history, we know, right? The ideology and practice. And I'm conscious of the ways in which even folks of color reinscribe that, right?
Okay.
And also center whiteness. So I think that we could always do the work, but I do appreciate the idea that sometimes the work has to be different based on the capacity of the individual and actually where they are. I guess the difficulty would be, how do you identify where individuals are in that work? Yeah.
Yeah. We just have a couple minutes before break. Any other things been stirring as we've been in the first half of the show?
No, just really enjoying, really enjoying the conversation on institutionalizing whiteness in particular. I've been sitting with it and thinking about, the 1960s and where we are in 2020 and how things haven't really changed. So there's some days I am hopeful and other days I have to search for that resolve. I was listening to Bob Marley, for those who listen to reggae, the redemption song. And part of the song is, we've poured in this generation triumphantly, but, can we all sing this song, right? So really asking individuals to all join in this, effort to advance equity and change.
Yes. And what you said from the beginning is in a collective way. Mm-hmm. And so white listeners, we're not talking about going as the white savior and you're going to revise the entire hiring practice, because now it's really finding the folk of color who have energy, commitment, competence, partnering with following leadership of collectively doing the culture change of the hiring practices, the marketing practices, what the website says. It's all critical to moving. In the last moment before break, can you let people know how to find you? Because I think we have some folks who would love to, given how you're showing up and your brilliance.
Thanks, Kathy. I'm Amoaba Gooden at me.com, AmoabaGooden at me.com.
When we come back, we're going to continue the conversation with Dr. Amoaba Gooden. I'm Kathy O'Bear, Center for Mantra and Change Radio. Center for Transformation Change Radio. When I get excited, I just switch my words and letters. Enjoy the break. We'll be back in just a few.
Everyone, I'm Dr. Pat. I'm the host of the Dr. Pat Show, and I am the creator of the Transformation Network, doing what we do in the world of positive radio, informed, educated, positive media. Independent radio hosts and independent networks have been the face of positive messaging over the past decade. So all of us here have decided we're going to put together an independent network that is going to enable people to bring their positive message of hope, inspiration, and conscious action to the forefront. Help us create a future of amazing, uplifting stories that can be told, so we can tell our children and they can tell their children of what hope and conscious action is all about.
I want to thank you all for tuning us in, turning us on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Stuck in a roundabout of dysfunction? Learn how to speak your truth to power with host Dr. Kathy O'Bear. Create real change with smart tools and smart strategies. No frills, no fluff, just life-changing conversations to help get you where you want to be. Extend your reach and become an agent for real change with Kathy O'Bear. For more information on Kathy and her work, please visit drkathyobear.com. That's drkathyobear.com.
Tune in to Maximum Resilience with me, Kelly Bazzani, your ally for addiction, the first Monday of each month at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Join us and engage in this epic journey of how to own your power and change your perception of addiction while we revolutionize the approach that ensures mental health as we address a worldwide epidemic. Take the steps that lead you towards an incredible life of maximum resilience. We do recover. Visit MyResilienceCoach.com.
Welcome back to the Center for Transformation Change Radio. I'm Dr. Kathy O'Bear. I want more time, Dr. Amoaba Gooden from Kent State, Vice President, Diversity, Equity, Inclusion. In the break, you said you saw an article today about what Texas did, which Florida's been threatening and some other states. Would you mind sharing what happened this morning, and we can talk about the consequences?
Yeah, just a short article, not a lot of details in it. What with the headline is that Texas has suspended DEI policies for all their public universities. And it really mentioned specifically diversity statements, but it did also reference other DEI policies.
Everybody breathe. You may have seen the model legislation from Manhattan Institute, and there was some other one. It was with probably end of or early February, maybe, in the Chronicle of Higher Ed. That was one of it. And they also, if I remember, said, and you can no longer consider race in hiring. So I've been spending, as I know you have, probably at least a decade trying to get colleges, universities, other organizations to infuse a race lens into marketing, recruiting, hiring, interview questions to truly get folks with racial consciousness, competencies, and not only demographic shifts. So what are you thinking as you hear about Texas, knowing that it's probably going to spread like wildfire throughout half the states in the U.S.?
Yeah.
Is my guess.
I have to think about this as kind of a larger, European colonial project. Right. That and I'm actually situating this alongside what's going on in the Supreme Court about race conscious admission, along with issues from last year around critical race theory. There is an effort to silence and to rewrite history around race in this country. And I think part of coming after diversity, equity, inclusion offices is really about that silencing Black and Brown voices, particular, because that really is the focus. Now, and I think I mentioned this before. I talked about James Baldwin's letter to Angela Davis when she was in jail, and the end of his that letter, I believe the quote was, "If they come for you, right tonight, they're going to come for me in the morning." And so I'm really invoking that to say this is really a call for collective action and allyship in all senses, where all individuals need to come together to push back against what's happening, because this will impact recruitment. It will impact hiring. It will impact the way that Black and Brown faculty thrive in these places. And so we need to think collectively about how we should respond. And I say collectively, Kathy, because I'm thinking of Sherry Watt's theory of being, who actually is a new book that came out, I believe, in 2022, that's really asking universities to rethink our goal focus, right? So we all want to get to the goal of hiring and recruitment. But what Watts and other publishers or the other authors are offering is that the process of getting to the goal is as important as the goal itself. So here I'm thinking about Bell Hooks, who I mentioned last week also when we chatted, her theoretical framework from margin to center. How are you going to include voices of those who are marginalized? That's where the expertise lies. But how do you spend time with those voices? How do you value them? And how do they have as much power in the decision-making process as those who don't look like them?
So possible changes, if folks haven't done it, I'm just brainstorming here, to have really honest, engaged conversations, whether it's focus group work with the faculty that are in the margins, Black and Brown particularly, what's working that has you thrive, what's not, what's getting in the way, what needs to change so that you feel with integrity you could help recruit, support, nurture, and really get the voices of the folks who are there, particularly those who have not bought into whiteness and white supremacy culture. Because as we all know, as you said earlier, there might be some Black and Brown Indigenous body people who are colluding, and that might be why they got hired. So particularly folks listening, finding the folks who are speaking out, speaking the truth, maybe asking graduate students, here's an idea, because especially the ones that are wanting to be faculty, what they see, what they've experienced, what needs to change. And then what are your thoughts about how to get voices of faculty and grad students in the hiring process?
Yeah, I was actually thinking about that as you were speaking. I think there has to be a reward structure. This is labor. This is time. Is it part of their workload statements? Are grad students being compensated or being offered consultant positions, right? Because they are so invested, of course, in their graduate potential, right? We want our students to get out. So I was, kind of offer this idea of thinking about our students as consultant experts. They can put on their CV. They don't have to commit to the regular committee meetings that take up so many time, but so much time, but they should be rewarded in some sense. And the same thing for faculty of color, you know, reduce workload statement, reduce teaching load, and a recognition of this work because it's such great value, you know, financially and qualitatively to the university that they're rewarded in some degree, shape, and form, including this being considered work that's valuable for tenure and promotion.
Could you imagine that this is centered in the quote service? Also was thinking that the emotional burden of participating in recruiting, hiring, as a white person, I actually found it kind of exciting and energizing. I wonder if Black and Brown Indigenous bodies, it's like exhausting. And so the compensation, not only financial, but just time, yes, comes to mind. There's a, yeah, differential impact.
Yeah, there is. And that needs to be recognized. And it tends to be an uncomfortable conversation with individuals who are not, right, racialized or minoritized. And frankly, what I've seen is that there is the assumption that that's easy work. It's really not valuable or meaningful work. So it shouldn't be recognized in some way, shape, or form. For sure, but it's we know, right? It's effort, it's time, it creates scars as we have to live through or relive issues that we've experienced in the past. For sure.
So that has me wonder if a new practice might be support of all the Black and Brown staff and faculty and hiring processes coming, opportunity to come together before, during, and after to debrief, connect, empower, tell the truth, and give strategies what needs to change next time.
Yeah. And having, you mentioned affinity groups earlier, just having multiple spaces where Black and Brown faculty can be away from the white gaze, if you will. So both authentic and organic spaces that they've created, but also planned spaces that actually allows them to actually share. And this does require creating a necessary space, which again comes back to our conversations about community agreements. Having those community agreements in a unit or a division or a department is so important because it actually sets a cultural landscape, if you will. So faculty of color know that they can actually use their voice to identify issues that they face, issues that they're seeing, so they won't be penalized. And I understand that sometimes that might seem like it's a dream, right? Because in reality, sometimes those spaces are not safe.
I was recently talking to some senior academic leaders, and some Black and Brown folk have been talking in my ear. And so I said, so what if, you know, the tenure process doesn't recognize all of this undervalued, incredible labor? And they're, oh, ours does. And we meet with the faculty and they can add to it. And I said, okay, so what if that's not their experience, that at the chair level, they don't feel that the advocate is there and then they kind of got quiet. And so do you know of any places again around the world, but what are the structures for faculty when the system of tenure, promotion, support is not what the academic leaders say it is? And what structures can be empowering but not retaliative? Any thoughts?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. So I do know that there's some institutions who, and that's probably well known, who actually create committees for junior faculty that are outside of the tenure and promotion process that actually assist with creating narratives, reviewing CVs, and serving as advocates and mentors. And they operate outside of the tenure process. And those committees are created with the junior faculty in mind in conversation with individuals such as the chair, for example. That's one thing that I know. I'm going to have to think about other places and spaces that might offer something different.
when I asked that, folks said, well, we have an ombuds for faculty. And I actually never heard that. I knew they sometimes have ombuds for the campus, but often it's student focused. Yeah. So they have one for staff and they have a separate one for faculty. So, and I said, so what are they, as they're hearing things, is there a feedback loop? And they say, we get themes. And I was like, I'm talking about who can walk with faculty and have a process. So the only other thought I had was some places do have a diversity, equity, inclusion leader within departments or colleges. But when I brought that up, some of the feedback I got was that's a very dangerous place to put this kind of advocacy. Because if they're advocating for their Black and Brown faculty, then they might be on that glass cliff of do all this work. But if we don't like what you're doing, then we'll just drop you right off. So that's as far as I got. But there's got to be something.
Yeah, it's really important. It just brings me, it just reminds me of something that individuals in those positions, Kathy, whether it's DEI work or any kind of organizational change work, really need to have job security, right? Mm. So this is why I always advocate for faculty and not to take anything away from staff, but a tenured faculty we know has much more power than an untenured, right? Than a staff member who's on contract for year to year. The ombudsperson, which I believe we're going to do that at Kent State, raises the question of how much power does that individual have to address change at the department level, particularly in unionized environments. Mm. We have a collective bargaining agreement and a handbook that is solely under the purview of a faculty in that department. And this is where some of the power lies, right, within that collective bargaining unit and those handbooks and where change needs to happen in terms of criteria for tenure and promotion, for example, in terms of whose voices actually get heard at the table when one is voting on a faculty file.
And so, again, I just want to be in charge of everything, you know, having somebody in there who is watching those dynamics and challenging the practice violations, because to have junior faculty interviewing and maybe even brown and Black faculty, junior faculty interviewing other, as well as infused in the hiring group. Mm-hmm. But to your point, when the decisions get made, often folks with more tenure, age, gray hair, dominate, take over, interrupt, bully. Mm-hmm. And so some of that accountability structure to intervene when those happen.
And then there's something I must speak to, and it's this idea that when racialized individuals exist in those spaces, they have a responsibility to speak up. It's not their responsibility to speak up. It is the responsibility of those who are committing, right, the aggression, the oppression. It is their responsibility to recognize their behavior and to change. So this is where, again, individuals with privilege, it is your responsibility to call your folks out, to attend to that behavior, and not to put that burden on racialized individuals.
So agree. Yeah. We have maybe 10 minutes. I have this wonder about, and I might have mentioned it last time, especially in this, now that Texas is saying they're reviewing. Before it was just threatened in Florida, Texas, and other places, maybe Oklahoma. So instead of a DEI statement, and one could argue if those are worth much, I've actually wondered if that's kind of 10 and 20 years ago. But today, I want people asking questions about, so I just give me pushback here. How are you creating classrooms, faculty department meetings, mentoring so that everyone succeeds? And using the student success, faculty success, staff success, graduating, career ready, using some of those strategic frames, which I'm finding more and more in strategic plans. I don't know if we have to say race. I wish we could, but if we can't, then I wonder if this focus on really supporting the success of all, how have you done it? How have you shifted your curricula? How have you shifted your practice? Yeah. And in these current times, how are you continuing to develop the life skills and career skills that all students need? That language, I just wonder if that, until they figure out ways to get rid of that, I wonder if that's a short term.
Yeah, I guess here's my tension with diversity statements. Is it being used as a model, if you will, or as a practice to reinforce whiteness in a way? So we're still hiring white bodies. So, and again, I'm really kind
That's
of
good.
Happy in thinking through the measures of diversity that we've put in place that hasn't changed the compositional diversity over space and time. So I'm kind of sitting with that for a while. So I wonder what could be different around the hiring practice. And certainly, and I know that the nation is moving towards this idea of being colorblind, right? I mean,
again,
what disservice is that going to is going to create? Where I think universities, again, I'm thinking about Sarah Ahmed's phenomenology of whiteness in terms of how white bodies recreate spaces and institutions of higher learning, and what they recreate is whiteness based on their past decision and their current decision. And unless we change the makeup of the universities, my fear is those decisions are going to continue into time, infinity.
So is what you're saying, like affirmative action, diversity statements have given white folks a way to say, this is what we believe.
Yeah.
And mostly white hiring groups think stated beliefs are enough.
Yes.
So I'm suggesting competencies. How have you? And real
yeah.
stories.
Yeah.
And again, it's.
And so I do believe in the value of diversity. So I'm sharing my fear about how they're being utilized as a quantitative approach to still continue to hire white bodies, because the white body is embodying diversity in their intentional action. And they might be, but how are they being used? And is that really changing the metrics and the compositional diversity of the university at all?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. You're by Bree. One other idea that I've seen it happen a couple places around onboarding, we've been focusing a lot on hiring here, onboarding and development. So I love the idea of this separate committee outside of the hierarchy and tenure to support junior faculty. There was a senior diversity officer in the Boston area that organized, I think, 5 or 7 other schools. Now, when I think about it, these were both examples are private schools. Now, that's interesting, but I think they brought in publics and they did, you know, every 6 or 8 weeks, gatherings for the recently hired, the medium and the long-term folks of color, indigenous folk. And it was an open food networking. Maybe there was a little program. And then another campus, 5 colleges in the Northwest organized, I believe it was a retreat. And so a several day experience for all of the new faculty of color, again, with mentors and formal and informal. And really across institutions. The other quick thought I'm having is those same institutions are probably talking about spousal hires, whether they are heterosexual relationships, same-sex relationships. And so because so much of hiring a person has to be family, whether it's kids in education, systems, partners, other people that also need to be employed. So those are some.
I love that idea. I actually love that idea of universities within a specific region collaborating on onboarding, but also the idea of hiring. I know HERC, Higher Education Resource Services, is part of what Kent State is involved in. What I like about that approach is that especially for universities that are in small spaces that are surrounded by larger communities, it does offer the faculty member to get to know, right, other members in the community, but also get to know the community in particular. I love that idea.
And given where you are, I actually know a couple folks, but you know a couple folks in that area. So folks listening, this can be among faculty, it can be staff, it can be combined.
And I like the idea of sustained onboarding. I mean, we might say sustained onboarding is turns into retention at some point, but this is idea that it's not just about a week or a month, but it actually is over a time, especially for organizations that might not have affinity groups, which sometimes does, as we know, offer a sense of community for individuals that are new, but intentionally planning, what does it look like to love, right? Kind of this bell hooks idea of radical love. What does it look like to love individuals that we're inviting into our spaces? How can we care for them and sustain them over their time in the academy?
one place I worked with years ago, I think they had a 2-year program, or maybe we broadened it into that. And so some of that initial 6 to 8 weeks, even the first quarter or semester, but then the needs shift as you get into the second semester and third and fourth, especially if they are on the tenure track or their contract faculty, staff. And then eventually some of the folks are like, well, I want to support the newer folk. And so it's just a continually regenerating, rejuvenating, theoretically compensated process.
Yeah, it's a wonderful idea, sustaining over a period of time. And then also allowing an opportunity, even within that first year, for our new faculty, racialized faculty, to share their needs and their concerns. What do they need to survive? What are they experiencing? Are they isolated? Do they need help with collaborating on a grant or an article or jumpstarting some new project? But just giving them an opportunity to use their voice over time, identifying what their success, right?
And doing it in groups where it's not like I'm the only one, then folks are, wait, I got this, I got that. Because chairs often may not be the ones that develop that really reciprocal relationship. They need to be, and chairs need to be trained how to do true faculty development support with a racialized lens. And just had a thought and it went, oh, what do you think the idea of burden, but the new faculty that want within maybe by second semester, there's a chance for them to share their research.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a space and a platform for them to be invited into the research area. I know at Kent State, our research and sponsor program is focusing on new faculty sharing their research. So they invite the community to hear our new faculty. Yeah.
I love it. It might be a panel with, you know, folks, different places on their research development.
Exactly.
What about share how you're doing advising? Again, different places on their career development, but also having new faculty with a race lens, or maybe it's a EDI lens. So we bring in around with students with disability, queer, trans, first generation, immigrant, and including racialized indigenous, and with all the intersecting. Can you imagine if that was once a semester, there was more people coming? This is what I'm learning as an advisor. These are some of the practices I'm trying. This is what didn't work.
Creating
and then some small groups, a community.
Creating a community, yeah.
But busting up that hierarchical classism, kind of white culture of you have to have been here 10 years in order to have something to add.
Yeah.
Somebody that literally has just been in for 4 to 6 months, if they don't think it's going to hurt their career, to share some of their practices.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. And Kathy, you know what I want to share is that for those who are in the midst of hiring, have gone through the hiring, reflect on what that practice is like. That practice is going to tell you about the culture of your department. So if there was tension around hiring a racialized faculty member, if there's conversation about good fit, right? If there is a privileging of whiteness, then there's work to be done at that department and unit level. And, you know, I'm having this conversation with colleagues about recruitment and recruiting faculty of color in a department that's just not ready for that faculty of color to be successful and to thrive. And that, you know, I sit with that tension, right? Because, you know, I personally want to recruit and recruit individuals that are racialized, that identify as members of the LGBTQ plus community. But do I do it if I know that they're going to be harmed at that department, if they're not going to be successful in that department? Yet, I know that that could be a reason for not inviting individuals in, right?
And so how do we have space pre, during recruiting, and post to get the real deal?
Yes.
Confidential space for folks to know this is what several people, this is what it's been like, is like.
Yes.
And so folk of color and indigenous folks come and choose to come. They come with all the information, and then these are the structures we're changing, and even the word support could feel a deficit model. So help me with another word, but these are the structures put in place to ensure that you're here in 5, 10, 15 years, because we want you here, we need you here, and we need to have more people changing our structures to support student success.
And that there's honesty to that, right? So, and if one has that conversation with incoming faculty, it's also coupled with the honesty of the challenges that the department, the university is facing. So people are not blindsided once they're in that space after a week or a month.
Yeah. I need a breath. Any final thoughts? We have about a minute, and please also let people know how they can find you.
Yeah, so Moaba Gooden, AmoabaGooden at me.com. And my last word is sustained, right? That this work, we have to be able to figure out how we can sustain this work over a period of time. And the focus is equally important. The process is equally important as the goal, and including a diversity of voices in the decision-making process really does impact the end result.
Yeah, with the power to influence. Thank you so much, Dr. Moaba Gooden. I can't wait for our third and final, maybe or not, conversation. And I've been wondering about community care, self-care, sustaining ourselves in this work.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that conversation.
All right. Listeners, all the best. Take care. We'll be back next month with Dr. Moaba Gooden. I'm Kathy Hebert, Center for Transformation Change Radio. Community care in these times. We'll see you in a month.
Take care.
You've been listening to Dr. Kathy Hebert on Transformation Talk Radio. Thanks for tuning in, and be sure to catch us next time as Kathy inspires listeners to become agents of change, motivate, innovate, and speak truth to power. Step into the courageous you that will change the world. Connect to life-changing conversations to extend your reach. For more information on Kathy and her work, please visit drkathyhebert.com. That's drkathyhebert.com.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.